about legislating for results. We tried to get this together because of your interest this session in performance budgeting and performance measures, so we brought in these experts to tell you about this process. And I'd like to just start with introducing Judy Zelio from NCSL, and she's going to introduce the other people that are going to talk to you. We have four PowerPoint presentations to go through. You need to know this is being recorded, so you have to be on best behavior today. So we have Judy from NCSL.
Thanks, Ken. Good morning. It's a real pleasure to be here. As Ken mentioned, Judy Zelio from NCSL. I'm with the fiscal affairs staff. I've been there 16 years. Many of you are already very familiar with NCSL. I've worked with Senator Westland on the Budgets and Revenue Committee. Senator Devlin has spoken at our meetings, and some of the other folks here also know NCSL very well. I understand the Ag Chair's recent meeting was very helpful. And some of you also have heard that I have a close relationship with the wife of Representative Esquivel. And Jan and I went to high school together in Missoula, Montana. And I won't tell you the stories of what we did when we were in high school, but we weren't all that bad. If you are not familiar with NCSL, I just wanted to point out a couple of things. We provide two legislators and legislative staff, all of whom are automatically members of NCSL, educational meetings, training, publications, an awesome website, and technical assistance at the request of legislative leadership. I want to thank Senator Schrader and Representative Scott for inviting us here today, and I appreciate all of you being here on Friday morning. And we are planning to talk about legislating for results, the concept of looking at what your citizens, the citizens you represent, are getting for the tax dollars that they spend. The idea of thinking that that is something that you want to keep in your mind as you do your budgeting. We are here and have worked for some years in collaboration with the Urban Institute. And the funding for this kind of service comes from organizations like the Smith Richardson Foundation, Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. That was a previous project. They funded a book and research called Making Results-Based State Government Work. Our current project is funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and the publication that you have there called Legislating for Results was funded by Annie E. Casey, and we are allowed under that project to come out to the states and help provide training and education in understanding it and using it. The idea of legislating for results is, as I said, thinking about the goals that government, using tax dollars, is supposed to be doing, how you measure whether or not you're making progress toward those goals, how you can assess the results that you are achieving or not, how you can obtain the information about those things and use that in your decision making, and then educating others about that process. In order to go out into the states and do this sort of work, we put together legislative and staff teams who have experience in doing some of the aspects of this particular approach. And they share information from their states about why they're doing this type of performance thought process, who's doing it, who participates in it, whether it's the executive branch or legislators or legislative staff, and provide you with practical tips about how they actually implement these ideas. If you want more information on legislating for results from NCSL, you can contact Harry Hattrie at the Urban Institute or give me a call or write to me. And many of you also may know Larry Morandi, who is the NCSL liaison from NCSL to Oregon. And if you want to figure out how to get stuff from NCSL, Larry's often the best person to start with because he knows how to wend his way through the labyrinth that exists there sometimes. I mentioned the teams that come out, and today we are very fortunate to have with us folks from other legislatures as well as Harry Hatry. Harry is the guru, I would say, of this whole concept of legislating for results. He's been working for years on it at the world level, at the national level, local level. In 94, he was here in Oregon to assess, if I'm not mistaken, the benchmarks program, mm-hmm. and is very pleased to come back and see what's been going on since that time. Gary Van Landingham here is with the Florida Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability, OPAGA. And Gary is he's interim director of that office. He has more than 25 years of experience working on accountability issues and has been deeply involved in NCSL. I served him as when he was director of, I'm sorry, the staff chair of what's now called the Budgets and Revenue Committee. Senator Westland also was involved with the Budget and Revenue Committee. And Anita Zinnaker also has been an officer of the NCSL Budgets and Revenue Committee, and she is assistant director with the Texas Legislative Budget Board, and she will share some experiences of Texas in this area. So I will stop here and introduce Harry. Oh, let's see, who's Gary? Okay, sorry. Who will give you a quick overview about what Florida has done with some of this information and why you might want to think about how you can use the wealth of information that Oregon already has available in, on performance. Gary, do you want me to do any of this, or are you going to push your own buttons?
Good morning. Happy to be out here in Oregon, where I'm happy to report that the weather is much the same as in Tallahassee. Well, it was foggy and about this temperature when I got there, so don't feel you're missing anything in Florida right now. So it's the only difference is that. but in Florida these days, we also are happy to report that it's not really, really windy there today. So it's after the four hurricanes that we had last year and the damage that's probably going to take us years to report. But on behalf of the Florida tourism people, I can say that if you were planning a Florida vacation, please come anyway because there's lots of cool stuff left. So I want to talk a little bit today about how Florida has used some of the information that our performance budgeting system brings into the legislature. We have a system that looks similar to yours in terms of all agencies are required to have performance measures in the budget. That's been reported to the agent, to the legislature for a long time. We started requiring performance measures back in the early 70s when we experimented with the old PPBS system. They had measures in there for a long time. They weren't particularly good. They weren't particularly useful. In 94, we established what we call the Government Performance Results Act, which in case we sort of revitalized our effort. Phase that in over a seven-year period of bringing agencies under a much stronger performance budgeting system, and since 99, all agencies have been under that system. And what it's allowed us to do is to do some really kind of neat analysis using this information that simply wasn't available before, that the legislature couldn't make these types of analysis to inform us decisions before we got that type of information. As you know, information is critical to the legislative process. I mean, legislatures need to know whether your policies are working. Legislatures deal with lots of really tough questions. We're under tremendous financial pressures these days, and that's not likely to change anytime soon. And Florida's going to have a good year this year, but our long-term projections indicate that in less than 2 years, we're going to be looking at about $1.5 billion deficit again. So while, you know, the good news is that things are getting better now in Florida and across the nation, we're not out of the woods, and I don't think we're going to be out of the woods for a while. So that means that the legislatures need to have a lot of information to make much more fine-tuned budget decisions much more targeted policy decisions than we've had to have in the past when times weren't that tough. The evaluation capacity is critical to the legislative process, and one of the things I think is really important to pick up on is this capacity needs to be within the legislature. You can't just rely on the agencies to give you information. You can't rely on the executive branch to give you this information for a couple of reasons. One is that agencies frequently don't come in and tell you, hey, we screwed up. You know that $2 million you gave us last year? Well, we spent it. We really didn't accomplish much with it, so please don't give it to us again. In Florida, I don't think I've ever heard an agency really come forward on that. That's probably true in most states. So the legislatures need a lot of ability to go out and really find out what's going on as part of your oversight responsibility. And executive branch information is often spun, as you know, that the agencies, as well as the executive branch in general, you know, they have their policy perspectives, they have their goals, and you need to be able to get past that spin and find out what's really going on out there in the agencies. And the good news is that performance budgeting can help address those challenges. It is a type of information that is incredibly powerful in terms of informing your budget decisions, informing your policy decisions, if you can use it in ways that do it, but that it work. And this is really important in public policy. Folks who come from the business sector know how important financial data is to assessing the health of businesses and your business plans. Well, that same thing is important for the legislature and for government. State government programs deal with tough problems. That's why they get dumped in government's lap. If it was something that was easy, then people wouldn't be coming up here before the Oregon legislature asking you to appropriate money for it. These are tough problems we're dealing with. We're dealing with problems with crime. We're dealing with problems with families. We're dealing with problems with individual behavior. These are tough problems to deal with. Legislatures need to know whether the money that you're appropriating to these programs that you're asking taxpayers to contribute are achieving the results that are dealing with those tough problems and are making things better. It's also important to have that kind of evaluation capacity because everything that government does tends to have consequences, and some of those are designed and some of them are not designed. And so things that create the incentives, structures that are out there that create outcomes that are not anticipated. For example, a lot of the poverty programs in the 60s and 70s and 80s, people started becoming aware of the unanticipated consequences of those. So the ability to really look at a program and say, not only is it achieving its goals, but what else is it doing that we may not be as happy with, it is critical to policymaking. And performance budgeting, again, can give you some of that information. And focusing this on outcomes is critical. Agencies, because of their daily responsibilities, tend to focus on the processes. They can tell you how many clients they serve. They may be able to tell you what type of services they're giving to those clients. They generally don't know what the long-term implications of those services are. Particularly, they don't know whether things are getting better or not because their job is to go out there and give services and put out fires. So when you get an agency secretary in here and you're asking them, well, what are we really accomplishing by doing this? They will probably rattle off, well, we spent all the money you gave us last year. We'd like 3% more. Here's how many people we served. Here's how many kids were in our classrooms. But in terms of the big questions, you know, are we preparing our kids for the jobs of the 21st century? You know, are we protecting our environment? Are trends getting better and things like that? That's not information that typically comes in the normal budget process. The good news is that performance budgeting can help deal with this. It gives you information that isn't otherwise available. It's very helpful as an early warning system of identifying trends that are starting to head the wrong way so that the legislature can start dealing with those problems before they show up in the papers, before it becomes a crisis, before it's an emergency situation. So that the trend information that performance budgeting can give you is very powerful as identifying things and then taking a proactive stance, which is very good for taxpayers because a lot of times if a problem can be headed off when it's early on, it's not a crisis situation where you've got to dump a whole lot of money into it. Can help focus management on results rather than processes. This has been very powerful in some of our Florida agencies where by implementing this that the agencies were able to look at their programs and say, well, hey, if this is what we're really trying to accomplish, maybe all these processes we've been putting in place for the last 50 years are no longer necessary or needed. Maybe we can streamline our operations. So by focusing the agency management on the results that you want them to attain, you can gain some real efficiency improvements out in the agencies. And one thing I wanted to really mention and focus on that we've done in Florida, which has had very powerful results, is using performance measures to create incentive processes for agencies. And what we're finding in Florida is that by putting a relatively small amount of money at stake, you can really drive system behavior out there in very powerful ways. And you can also get unit cost information that can help you compare providers, can help you compare how much does it cost government to do this service, is it similar to something that's being done in the private sector, are we more efficient, would outsourcing be a good option here? So it can do a lot of good things for us. And the reason this is good information for us is because without this type of information, all the incentives for the legislature are to keep doing what you've been doing. Agencies will come forward with a budget request. It's a continuation budget. They will ask you to keep funding the things that are going on. All the lobbying groups will ask you to keep funding the things that are going on. So unless you have a different type of information that clues you in that, hey, this isn't working, and hey, there are different options out here, it's very easy to just continue the status quo when that may not be the appropriate thing to do. So this information can help inform the budget decisions. What are we getting for our spending? Are these programs cost-effective? Are there options out there? What are other states doing? And how would our outcomes change if we accepted the agency's budget recommendation to increase spending by 10%? Rather than just by saying, well, by doing this, we'll be able to reduce our waiting list by 500 people. Well, what's that really mean in terms of the long-term outcomes? Why we're doing this program? This information can help address some of those big questions. What we have to do is sort of focus in Florida of how we use this information in our workforce development system. Florida has a very complex workforce development system. It's a big state. We have lots of providers out there, and we were able to use the performance budgeting information to really drive that system in ways that produce some good benefits for both the legislature and for our citizens. When we started doing this performance budgeting system, one of the things that we knew is that we had lots of providers out there, but there wasn't a whole lot of information of how that really worked. We knew that we had programs out there that school districts did. We had programs community colleges did. We had a lot of people with their fingers in the pie, but nobody really had an idea of what this pie really looked like. So one of the things that my office was asked to when this information first started coming in was, can you just sort of lay this out? How does our workforce system operate? Can you put this on one sheet of paper so we can see it? And we did. And this is Florida's workforce system as it existed. It was incredibly complex. We had over 270 different entities working in this. We had four or five state agencies here. We had four or five coordinate bodies here. We had lots of providers out there. And we call this the umbrella chart because it's sort of the only thing that made sense in terms of, we have this umbrella of workforce development system, but sort of God knows what's underneath it and whether those programs are working. And we decided to put this sort of spider web thing on here because it was, you know, the linkages here were so tenuous, it was sort of like, well, you know, maybe if something twitches over here, you can run out there and see what's going on like a spider does. But in terms of really driving the system, this made it very clear to everyone that we had a problem. We had a system which nobody could make sense out of. Particularly if you're thinking about this in terms of someone who's trying to get training, you know, from the client's perspective, from our citizen's perspective. You say, well, you just go out there and find something. It didn't really meet the needs of anybody. Didn't meet the needs of the legislature, didn't meet the needs of providers, didn't meet the needs of our citizens. So by sort of just laying the stuff out using the information that we were getting under performance budgeting, it was able to sort of let the legislature say, hey, we've got a problem here. We also noted that many of these programs provided the same services. So that not only it was very complex, but you could go to this program or this program or this program, and it's essentially the same program, even if they're dealing with the same service area or the same populations. So we had programs that were duplicating themselves all over the state. They were serving the same populations. You might have a community college and a school district, or in Florida, because the community colleges generally serve several school districts. You know, if I wanted to get training in auto mechanics, I could go to five different places. And there was no information in terms of whether those programs were effective or more cost-effective or things like that. It was just a hugely complex system. So the legislature took this information and said, we've got to make sense out of this. Instead of having two state-level entities trying to drive this system, let's just have one, and we'll call it Workforce Florida Public-Private Partnership. And then we'll regionalize this to have regional boards that are driving the system, and then we want one-stop centers where if someone wants training, they go one spot, and we'll assess them and give them their needs. Much more streamlined system. So this is our current workforce system. It's still somewhat complex, but at least it makes some sense. And there's one spot that citizens can go into and get these services, and there's much more coordination in the system. And this was information which our performance budgeting system allowed us to understand what was really going on out there, because before this, nobody did. Once we got into that and sort of made sense out of the system, then the next question is, well, how are these programs doing? And we were able to take the information that we were getting from these providers because we required them all to provide certain types of information and found the performance was incredibly mixed throughout the state. The good news was the program was meeting most of its performance standards. So on one hand, you could say that, well, okay, you're getting people through these programs, they're getting benefit rises, the wages are rising, so that's a good thing. But once you really delve into the data, you'd find that the system, well, in terms of getting jobs, well, more than half the people got jobs, and that was a good thing. The bad news is if you really looked at it long term, a lot of those people who got jobs couldn't keep them. So were we really making them better off? But we also found that the program completion rates were very low, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. So looking at how the system was working, some good news, people are getting through them sometimes. If they get through them, they're getting benefits, but lots of folks aren't getting through them. And many graduates, even after we got them through a workforce system that was supposed to make their life better, were still earning very low wages. Yes?
What mechanism did you use to track this data? For example, that program completion rates were low or that they were earning low wages. What was the survey mechanism?
One of the things that Flora has, and we've done a good job on, is we have a very complex data tracking system where all of our providers have to put data into the system in terms of their graduates, people entering them, so we can track at a central level things like completion rates, and we also can track them using ID numbers, what happens to them after they leave the programs. So our data systems helped us to do this, but I think even if, in the absence of that, you'd have to go and work with the providers, but it's still something that's fairly critical to this system. Give you an idea of the wages. I mean, this is part of the good news here. If you went through a community college AA degree program, you came out and made about $6,000 more within a couple of years of graduating. Community college certificates, again, about $6,000 there. School district programs weren't as successful. You came out about $3,000, $2,500 ahead if you made it through one of those. But the sort of good news is that, hey, if you made it through one of these programs, your wages did go up. You were better equipped to provide for yourself in life. But completion rates were really pretty low and were abysmally low in many types of programs. The best news was our community college credit certificates, where almost half the people made it through. If you look at those AA degree programs, where the good news was you made $6,000 more if you made it through, the bad news was only 15% of the people made it through. And this is in a 5-year period, so that's not really good. The school district programs, we were getting the neighborhood of about a little more than a quarter of the people through, and all workforce programs, we were getting somewhere between a quarter to a third of the people through these programs, which is a cause for concern. In terms of how people are doing here, we found that we were training people for programs which they really couldn't make a job that would support their family once they got through this. The community college programs were better at this than school district programs. Almost half of the people we sent through a workforce program run by a school district still, they were making a little bit more than they were before, but not something they could support their family in, which then made us look at, well, what types of things are we training them for? And we found that we were training, tens of thousands of cosmetologists and things like that, which, a good profession, but not something you're going to go and support a family of four or five on and send your kids to college and things like that. We looked at this sort of to get an idea of overall comprehensiveness, looking at three key variables for these programs, which were their outcomes. Did you have programs that very few people made it through? Did we have some programs that nobody made it through? So if we looked at this, does the program have less than five completers on it? We find that, in some cases up to 16% of the programs we had operating in the state of Florida were, no matter how many people we got through it, only five or less people were actually graduating at the end of this. Had programs where less than half of the people were employed after getting through it, or jobs that were less than $5 an hour. And these are trend lines over time, and I'll talk about why some of those things are getting a little bit better, but lots of programs, if you look consistently, had very poor outcomes. The legislature then said, hey, we've got to do something about this. This data was very powerful to them, and they said, well, using this, we've got to change the system. We're spending a huge amount of money for this program. We're putting people in programs that don't really help them, and they're not making through them anyway. So what we did is we changed the enrollment system from the old way of doing it, which was you put somebody in the seat and we'll give you money for putting people in the seat, to we will start paying you for your outcomes. And we didn't do that totally. We did that on what we called an incentive basis, which was neighborhood of 90% of your funding was continued to be based on your enrollment, but 10% of the money, which is basically the new money that we were putting into the system, was going to be based solely on performance. So if you could continue doing what you're doing, but you're not going to get any more money for that. Yes?
How did you fund, or how did the system fund programs that are socially viewed as important that are on a downward spiral?
What the system does by doing this is it forces the providers to make those decisions, which is, we're not going to tell you can't have a cosmetology program, or we can't tell you that you're not going to have, you know, a child care program or some other program. That's still your decision. But we're not going to pay you for very much for that program if you don't start getting results for it. Well, this is all workforce stuff here, so this didn't get into elementary's schools. It can be applied to that, and we haven't in some ways. But basically what we said is that we're going to drive the local systems, the local providers, the school districts, community colleges. We're going to create an incentive for them to reform their own programs. And this produced dramatic results in just a couple of years, results that surprised everybody by how quick these changes occurred and how dramatic they were in terms of the outcomes of these programs. What we found is that the potential of getting new money based on performance forced the system to say, we've got to change how we're doing things. So this forced the system, which was very decentralized, to change a lot of things very quickly. What we found is that after doing this, and we did this in 95-96, the first year the number of poor performing programs based on those three criterias fell by almost 40% in 1 year. And that trend has continued. So where we're having almost half of our programs were poorly performing, we're down to about 21% now. We haven't updated this data for a couple of years, but that trend, I'm fairly confident, is continuing. Programs that had very low wages are starting to die off in the state. More wages, more programs are having people earn at least $12 an hour once they get out. The ones that were very low, which is basically the minimum wages, are pretty much dying out in the state of Florida. So these providers are saying, hey, we can't afford to have trained people for minimum wage jobs. And again, this was based on, you know, 5 to 10% of their funding. Higher employment rates is also getting better. More programs are having more than 75% of their people employed instead of, and again, the ones that have less than half of the people employed are, again, dying off in state. Once we sort of licked that problem, we wanted to dive into this a little bit more. What are the outcomes for different types of providers? Do we have program providers out there that are just doing a great job and have best practices we should try to emulate throughout the state? We have programs that are just not getting it that we need to do something on. What we found is that there's a real difference between our school district programs and our community college programs in terms of their outcomes. On the average, community college programs do much better. And some other states have consolidated these programs. So one of the issues we have is, should we change this, move more and more of these programs to community colleges, so your school district programs simply aren't doing a very good job on this?
Larry, just so you know, I think we're missing a page in the presentation.
Okay, we'll get you the slides. So.
Full disclosure, it's an efficiency measure, it's because I help collate these.
Okay, bye. Oh, excuse me. Yeah. Further reducing costs. So this basically sets up that the difference between the community college programs and school district programs. On virtually every measure we looked at, the community college programs are stronger. And the legislature is now starting to grapple with, you know, can we move some of these programs from school districts to community colleges? Partly because the community colleges in Florida are much more workforce-oriented. It's one of the core missions of school districts. School districts are funded basically still for everything else they do with how many seats you're filling. So that question is still out there. Yes?
This gets to one of the questions you've asked before. Since part of your workforce development is the community colleges and that's one of your better performing areas, mm-hmm. and community colleges tend to serve certain geographic areas, what did you do when you had a community college that was not performing?
One of the things we found was that the trustees of the community, the question was, what do we do with community colleges that aren't doing a very good job? And one of the things that we're finding is that the trustees of the community colleges pay a lot of attention to this. So if you're a president of a community college and you're not doing very well in this area, then the trustees of the community colleges are putting a lot of pressure on them. In some cases, can force the community college president out if they're not moving in this direction. So again, this is creating an incentive that the local decision makers in Florida, the community colleges, are all report, the presidents report to a local board of trustees. And the nice thing for the legislature is it doesn't force the legislature to make all those decisions saying that, okay, in Manatee County, we're going to move this program from this provider to that provider. And it forces that decision down and gets the legislature out of those local politics decisions, which, as you know, can be kind of messy. Yes? In terms of school district, the question is, how do we stage discussions on community colleges and universities or community colleges and school districts?
One of the issues that we're facing is exactly what you're talking about, that the K-12 system is based on the community, the money, and so the thought is to try to get a productive discussion going about how we can most efficiently use the school system rather than on whose turf is going to be carved up.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, the question of, you know, how do you deal with the question of what you're trying to drive the system towards, I think it goes along several different tracks. And Florida's got, for K-12, we put a very strong accountability system in place. We call it our A-plus plan. So we grade the schools for the K-12 systems based on their outcomes. We've been doing this a couple of years before No Child Left Behind came into play. For the workforce programs, it's still kind of a problem there. It's hard to get the school district's attention in some of these areas because workforce is a smaller piece of their pie than it is for the community colleges. So I certainly can't claim that we've totally fixed this problem, but it's certainly starting to move towards that direction, but it's probably going to be a while before it's totally resolved. Yes? Question is types of school district programs. The school districts run basically the vocational technical centers generally report to the school districts in Florida. So they would do anything from auto mechanics to cosmetology to diesel mechanics. They have a wide range of programs out there. And there's not a lot of rhyme or reason for some of those programs. In the past, those programs were basically, if you started one in 1959, you still have one, so long as you can find enough people to fill the seats. So they're starting to think more about, you know, is this something we still need to be training people in? LPN programs, a lot of the school districts would run those, the community college programs. The community colleges would generally pick up RN programs. So, is a question back here? Yeah. Yes?
You said that you're giving away from programs that would produce minimum wage jobs. Mm-hmm. What about CNAs? I mean, where there is need for training and are very low-paying jobs, where does that training come from?
While we are trying to minimize low-paying jobs, I think so long as there is a market there and there's a need for it, then the community colleges and school districts can continue to offer it. I think that they would concentrate more on things like placement rates to make sure that, well, seeing as we need a lot of CNAs, then let's make sure that they get jobs when they're getting out, because they'll get points in the system for placing the people in jobs, even though they won't get a lot of points for the wages that the people get. So. Another forward example that I won't really go into in depth on this was community mental health. excuse me. Before we did this, community mental health in Florida was a black hole for the legislature. We had lots of community providers out there, and they would come forward to the legislature every year and say, you gave us $2 million last year, we want $3 million this year. And the legislature would ask, well, you know, how many people do you serve? And they'd say, we can't tell you, that is confidential. Yeah. What type of services do you provide? We can't tell you that it's confidential. And, well, is anybody getting better? Well, we can't tell you that it's confidential, which is frustrating to the legislature. So under program budgeting, we said, okay, you don't have to tell us who, you don't have to identify your clients, but you do have to start giving us information on your services. You know, we want you to identify how many people you're serving, what types of services that you're providing. We want pre- and post-test in terms of their functioning in this program. And this is, again, the first time we're starting to get information on, okay, we can now look at the system of community mental health providers out there, and we're seeing dramatic differences now on this data. That folks in Orlando are serving people at $10,000 a pop, while the people in Tampa are doing it at $4,000 a pop. What's going on here? You know, are there things that we really need to pay attention to? Are the people in Orlando really different than people in Tampa, or are you just doing things very differently, that everybody who walks in the door gets X whether they really need X or not? So we're just starting this emphasis to look at this, but I think this is another area where any place you've got lots of providers out there and not a lot of accountability, you can use this type of system to really drive the behavior. Yes?
Well, NCSL seems like they could be of greatest value to the states in listing in a common location such things as performance measures. And we're designing our own performance measures, and I'm asking whether or not, and how we compare with other states. We're saying, well, you know, they all have their own way of doing it, mm-hmm. but if there was a database where we could see performance measures used in mental health in other states, then we could not have to keep it trying to get through, but the wheel, we could utilize the best of other states and vice versa.
Yeah, we quote you on that.
Yeah, I think there's lots of information that states can share in terms of, we tried this, it didn't work, we tried this, it does work. I think NCSL is a wonderful forum for that type of information. Seeing as states provide services in different types of service networks, you know, what one state may be doing for measures may not fit totally with another state, but it certainly would help everybody to avoid reinventing the wheel. So I think it's a great idea.
Is it happening?
It's a goal.
give us a deadline.
NCSL is a tremendous centralized resource for, you know, we tried this and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
If you want it on, you know, in a 10-page report, it's not all states combined, but you can find out what Minnesota and Maryland and Tennessee did.
Mm-hmm.
Something should be done fairly quickly to be a listserv on performance measures for those that want to have contact.
Right. Yeah, the more you talk about this area, the more you realize that there's lots of great ideas out there in the states, but the technology transfer, I think, is a challenge of, you know, Texas does some really cool stuff, Minnesota does some cool stuff, you're doing some cool stuff, how can we all learn from that and move the overall system forward? Because it's very easy, particularly in this, where often there's huge expectations that are quickly disappointed, to say that, hey, let's keep the expectations reasonable here, here's what this can do for us, and here's ways of helping us get there. So, there's a question back here?
That may be more of a statement than a question, but looking through your data on your performance measures for your community colleges, that was output data, great.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at that, if you should be doing some of that picture here. We just talked about the black hole in mental health costs, which is the same norm as yours.
Yeah.
You started talking about what it costs in one part of the state versus what it costs in another part of the state as far as participation is concerned. And I was thinking myself, and it seems to me that's just sliding back into input, not output. If you don't put it in, you don't put in, you can measure it for information.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't tell you what the output is.
Right.
What I really want is looking, what I keep telling myself is looking for output, like you did in the participation system.
Mm-hmm.
But looking for output in social services can be extremely difficult.
Right.
And I would like through NCSL, I'll have a discussion of that from other states. Then we're looking at 5, 10, 15 years out on these situations, because that's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at 12 months later or 6 months later, it doesn't tell you.
Right.
But you want output data, not input data, correct?
Right. Yeah. Question is, the types of measures and... do you want inputs versus outputs? I think a good measure set has all of this. You need to have the inputs, obviously, because that's what drives your budget decision. I mean, agencies are generally funded on inputs. That's what they focus on. You want outputs because you want to know the number of widgets, the number of services that they're providing, and you've got to have the outcomes, too, in terms of what's happening here. And I think that something like performance budgeting, the more you have it in place, the more powerful it becomes, because it's really the long-term trend lines that you want to pay attention to. For example, here, if you looked at just 1 year, sometimes you would see that the programs may have had a good year, but then they had a bad year. Well, if they only have 1 year of data, then you don't really know that this is a long-term trend, we've got to fix it, or it's just, well, you didn't do a good job screening classes, or you had a hurricane come through in Florida, and that's why things went south that year and things like that. So you really need to have the system that does all three things. It helps, you know, make your input decisions, your budget decisions, helps you identify what services that people are getting, and then also looks at those outcomes for short-term and long-term, because particularly I agree that in social services, it's the long-term outcomes we have. Lots of programs can tell you in criminal justice or mental health or drug abuse that, well, you know, they didn't use drugs while they were in our program. Well, you sort of hope not because they were locked up. But, you know, how are they doing 6 months later? How are they doing a year later? How are they doing 5 years later? Because that's what we're trying to keep people from recidivating there. So I think that's very important. Yes?
Could you expand a little bit on this concept of what point you force agencies to make the decisions? Because when you were showing this chart, it's all convoluted. Practical example that we're having right now, we're hearing some testimony from the Department of Education, their operating budget, which is $90 million, $50 million federal funds, $40 million state funds. They've got kind of a chart like this also.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, from my viewpoint, how am I going to actually rate those performances? I don't know if they're only performance measures, or how we're supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, they could be probably operating that agency, but $20 million less.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing I've struggled with is how do I get up there and actually find out those facts and say, okay, how much
are
you
going to change? The question is what you do with administrative processes. And in Florida, we've been working on that. I don't think we have a silver bullet on it yet. We do have things like for all agencies, because you have a finance and accounting office, we want to have measures that tell us what your efficiency is on that, that we can say, you guys, you know, for the amount of money we're putting into here, you're handling, you know, 500 travel vouchers, you guys are handling 800 travel vouchers, you guys are handling 2,000 travel vouchers. What are you guys doing well that maybe we can get these guys to do it? Or maybe we should have you do it for these guys because you're doing a better job. You know, maybe we should centralize some of these administrative services rather than have them out at every agency.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's always an option of, you know, forcing the cut, saying, okay, you're going to have to do this at 5% less next year, and come forward with a plan and let us see it to make sure that you're not doing what agencies tend to do, which is, if you're going to give me a cut, I'm going to cut the most politically popular thing. Let's close the National Monument. And so I think there needs to be this ongoing discussion on that and ongoing monitoring. Agencies will play games if you let them, and you need to have a system that doesn't let them.
Gary, I could comment on that if that would be helpful. In Texas, on a biennial budget, I believe you are as well. And when the legislature convened 2 years ago in 2003, they were facing a $10 billion deficit or shortfall in revenues. And part of it was to finish up the year they were in, and then the other part spilled over to the next biennium. And agencies were asked, it was something that we had to do at that time. In general, they had not anticipated that large of a challenge. And so agencies were asked to develop budgets, brand new ones, differently than they had filed originally as appropriations requests, and told to bring in a budget at 12.5% lower than they were operating at that time. So all agencies did that. There were a few exempted programs, but each agency was challenged with that. And we found that in that case, I wouldn't say it's ideal, but it was ideal in the sense that everybody was pulling towards the same end. And so we did have some administrative cuts that probably would not have been made under previous budget reviews.
One of the things we did in Florida as well is we required agencies to develop core process maps internally and provide those to the legislature, which basically says, okay, administratively, here's what you're trying to accomplish. We want you to lay out the steps, and then we want you to think about, is there ways that you can streamline this process? And some of the agencies who really took this to heart did some really kind of neat things to do that said, you know, if we're really trying to do this, then we don't really need to do it this way. And we could do it this way, and we can either free up money to spend on something else, or you can cut our budget and things like that. You know, I think the reality in Florida is that, as in any system, you have some people who really take it to heart and do a wonderful job. You have some folks who do okay on it, and some folks throw some measures up against the screen and hope that, it satisfies people and they go away and leave them alone. The agencies that did a good job on this, who really took it to heart, produced some very powerful results and some sort of streamlining and going through sort of their drains and unclogging them to improve the processes. Yes?
I don't want to raise any concerns with my colleagues on this question, but what do you do when you give out funding by formula
mm-hmm.
and you have low-performing and high-performing entities that ultimately receive that, that are actually partners but not actually part of their government
mm-hmm.
directly, and you can't actually reward or sanction
right. Question deals with formula-based programs. Oh. One of the things is that in Florida, our workforce system was formula-based. And what we were able to do is to basically tweak that formula to put a performance measure in there and to create, basically, for the new money, okay, we're going to continue your formula-based for consisting ones.
We should probably move along because Gary's already a little behind, and then there's discussion at the end of the session, so... I don't want anyone not to answer good questions. I'm going to help them out, but let's see if we can maybe write those down.
Just to give you a little bit of information on OPAGA, we're the legislature's policy research unit, and one of the things that we spend a lot of our time on is you know, working with the legislature to go through this information and to package it and to make sense out of it. As you know, you get lots of information in. Making sense out of it and interpreting it and realizing what's important and what's not is a huge job. And to the extent that you can, you know, get your folks to do that, to help you with that, then I think that the information that you get is going to be much more powerful and much more useful to you. Thank you.
We clap over the budget.
We hope to have a little bit of time at the end for you to ask some other questions, but do feel free to ask as we go because you may miss something otherwise. So Harry Happy is going to speak next, and as I mentioned, he is the guru of all of these sorts of things. He has very national knowledge about these kinds of results-oriented programs that are going on in the states and at other levels of government as well.
Actually, they've sandwiched me between the two important people from Texas and Florida. I know what this guru business is. The Urban Institute, by the way, is a private nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that does research for all levels of government and international as well. I'm going to quickly go through the first couple of slides here. Gary has covered the reasons for performance, legislating for results. There's basically two basic uses for performance measurement and legislating for results information enables people to both itself make more decisions as well as encourage the executive branch to focus more on decisions. Now, the key problem here is you have to do two things. First, you have to obtain the information, and secondly, you have to use the information. The new kid on the block is the interest in recent years is on outcome information. As probably most of you know, most of the past work and over the years has been on inputs, costs, and also on outputs, process activities. But the new thing in recent years is the focus is on outcomes. Can I steal something?
Sorry.
I think it's over there.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
Now, I assume you all have a copy of this. I'm going to be talking a little bit about drawing from this. This is the piece that was prepared with the help of an advisory group of from 12 different states, half of which were elected legislators and half were legislative staffs. So for more details, you can look through this. We hope you'll have a chance to thumb through it. We don't expect anybody to read it from page 1 to page 20, whatever it is, but at least you can spend a little bit of time looking at it when you have a chance. The first thing I want to do is talk about some basic actions for getting better information. Action one is really the fundamental piece that you're struggling with now in Oregon. It's getting useful, timely information reporting on individual programs and to put in targets as well into the programs. This is a basic. If you don't have good information, how can you do performance budgeting? I mean, it's really a problem. You've got to have good information in the first place. The next slide is basically a set of indicators just to illustrate what you can do with trying to get good indicators, be good measures. That's the first problem. This is a set that basically we've drawn from the state of Hawaii. And this was prepared by the Hawaii Department of Human Services Social Service Division in its 2005-2007 budget. Now, it's a subset of indicators from about 40 or so. These are the six on the screen and seven in your handout. They're, by the way, I'm going to be using some handouts behind. After page 12, there are five handouts that you will probably need. In this case, the first two indicators basically focus on the issue of mistreatment of children. The next four focus on the next four on the success and timeliness of the placement. This is a program basically for neglected dependent children focusing on foster care and adoption services. These are fairly straightforward indicators that many states are beginning to use. You have some of them that are contained. Some of these are contained in your annual performance reports, but not all of them. But they're a pretty good set. One of the important points about this is that the legislature is going to need to focus on a small number of indicators, of measures. There's no way you can handle the 40 or so for every one of these programs. It's impossible and practical. So you need to focus on. Usually, the good part of it is that usually it is enough to focus on one or two of these special the indicators at a time for in any given year. Now, the next action is a key one for you in terms of getting this information. You're really going to need the legislative staff to help you. In the case of Oregon, you're talking about the legislative fiscal office. It's not very large, and to some extent, they will need to probably get some help from the executive branch, the budget and fiscal analysis, and I think they already have pretty good relationships with them, so they can be used to help you identify the important elements. With all the data that you're being shown, I mean, looking at through your annual performance reports, it's an immense amount of information and data. And the dilemma is to pick out what's important, the highlights, what's important to focus on in the particular period of time you're interested in, the biennium in this case. And they can be of extraordinary help from you in doing that. The next action, action three, is to ask agencies for explanations for poor outcomes. It's very important to recognize that the information coming from the performance measurement process in Oregon or in any state does not tell you why the data are the way they are. They do not tell you why. It's like if you were manager of a football team, the manager and the legislators need to know the running score. But knowing the score at any point in time, after the first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter, does not tell them what's wrong, why they're losing or why they're winning. It could be the quarterback, could be the defensive players, the offensive players, it could be the manager, could be outside. After all, government is only a small player in most of these outcomes. Government does not do everything. Your citizens have a role in delivering these outcomes. The businesses do. The weather does. All sorts of events from outside that the agency does not control. It's a basic point. If you look at the... I pulled out in your next handout behind... It's labeled 2A. I pulled out the actual program from the annual, your annual performance report for influenza vaccinations. Now you already have on surface you have pretty good process. You've been asked, the agencies have been asked for a lot of very important information. The problem always is the implementation of that. You know, there was this great New Yorker cartoon of Moses waving the Ten Commandments on his up in the air and saying to the Lord, "Lord, but what about implementation?" Takes a little while, but it's implementation is tough. We got to worry about that. Now, there's an item on page 2, item 4 in this presentation, and they are required now. The agencies are required to provide explanations, and item 4. For this program does provide an explanation. Now, in this case, the explanation for not meeting the target for 03 was that there was unexpected consumer demand. Now, in 05, in 04, you're going to find an explanation. They're not going to meet their target because there was not enough vaccine. Now, one of the problems here, in looking through your explanations, most of them are pretty weak. You don't have very much. And one of the things I would urge you to do as legislators is when you see a missed target, look at the explanation. If you're not satisfied with it, obviously get back and provide more information. This is a new system you've got here, really. This is new stuff. So you can't expect a great deal. But that explanation section, that little section, can be extraordinarily important in helping you to interpret what's going on and deciding what to do next. Because if you don't have that, you're going to be in trouble. Now, at this point, we want to illustrate for you, we have a little audio excerpt that Judy Zilio is going to run through for you on the search for good outcome information.
The excerpt that we'll be playing from the CD is on the CD that you have with your book, which is sort of a guide for you on thinking about these processes. The excerpts that we have on there from legislative hearings are designed to illustrate some of the principles that we're talking about.
Project RIO, our state-funded program for ex-offenders, exceeds our targets for the number of participants served, and even during this economic downturn, we're very close to meeting our entered employment target.
What constitutes serving someone in that? Do you measure it before they actually are placed in a job?
We have a couple of measures, and I'll bring your attention to that. One has to do with actually when we provide the services, yes, and they are placed in the job, we also have the cost to serve. Look under strategy B11, follow down to the output measures, number of RIO program participants served, and you see that target this year is 21,480, and we're at 70%, but if you look, this is only through February. March and April look even better, so we're actually believe we'll meet that target overall, the 21,480.
But we don't have on the report the actual number placed in jobs in relation to the actual number that came through your door.
We have placed 68% of 20,974 is the number of absolutely entered employment.
And do we track how long, or through that, the Project RIO, how long they stay employed?
Yes, sir. We do have a Project RIO plan working with TDCJ, and part of that is doing the follow-up and to look at that employment. And I can get more information to you on that.
But that's not reflected on your
time frame. No, it's not in our measures.
I would be interested in knowing how that shakes out.
Yes, sir.
Did you hear how persistent the legislator, the chair of the committee, was in trying to get at the information that he really needed to know? When he was probing, the agency head moved on to cost information. Finally, with his questioning process, he got to the question about how many people were actually employed and how many stayed in those jobs. This one? We're going to go to the next one in a little bit.
The idea of this little disc that you have inside the front page of the book, so we assume that you'll put this into your automobile radio playing as you're driving to work each day. That's the idea.
Action 4 is... you're good. Once you start getting the data, the next thing that people get concerned about is the quality of the data. Is the data any good? And the problem is how to do that, and that's tricky. Everybody's becoming concerned as they get performance information. What's the quality of that data? People like Texas, for example, and Anita may mention this, requires a state auditor to annually review a sample of the performance measures, and they're supposed to attest to the extent to which those indicators and that data for those indicators are any good. And if not, there's supposed to be follow-up to see that that's improved. That's one approach that people have used to do this. Action 5. Yes, sir.
Some of us are real concerned that the information we're getting to either our team or counseling them, I just don't trust them when we've had some bad experiences the last session on that. And we asked and looked into the possibility of outside source stuff for the state government. We've not been very successful in the agency state government while that happened. What's the experience of other states? If other states need to hire outside groups, businesses commonly will ask for audits from outside groups because their own internal audits are often prejudiced because it's a lot of the routine in large businesses every 4 or 5 years in outside audits.
Right. Well, most states I know have, of course, gone to their own audit staffs in the state audits to do this sort of thing. I mean, I assume the legislature has the ability, if they want to hire some outside contractor to do it. I would think that's possible. Not to my knowledge. Do you two know? Anyone know?
Some states outsource some parts of auditing. And we'll do some types of audits with their auditor general staff or the state audit staff. We'll outsource other types of studies. It's a mixed bag on that. There's also a mixed bag on when states have tried to do sort of statewide reviews of their operations, sort of national performance review type things at the state level. Texas has done that several times with in-state staff. A number of states have done it with in-state staff. Some of them have formed public-private partnerships. Some have tried to bring in big, you know, big consulting firms to do statewide audits. The experience tends to be that hiring an outside firm tends to be expensive, and there's a big learning curve in that they're trying to understand government, which is different than business. So there's cost incurred with that. They will come up sometimes with things which in-state people won't because they're more familiar with things that businesses may be doing in terms of supply chain management and things like that. So I think it depends a lot on how you do it, not necessarily just doing it or not.
Keep in mind that there's enormous amount of data each year that comes out of this process, and you can only really audit or examine a small proportion of it. That's why sampling typically has been used to do that. Ultimately, the quality of the data resides really with the people who are delivering it, the managers at the lower level, and some procedure. At the federal government, where they've been wrestling with this problem a great deal, some of the inspector generals, they have inspector generals in each of the departments that are supposed to also, even there, they have limitations of what they can do. It's a problem. It will continue to be a problem. Where you have suspect data, you should certainly arrange for some sort of audit. That's clear. Item 5, Action 5, is providing training. both to legislators and to legislative staffs. We understand in Oregon that already the Oregon Progress Board, as well as the Legislative Fiscal Office, already done some of this, and that's very good. What I want to do now is discuss some actions for the second major step, which is to use the information. Gary has already mentioned some of this, but we'll go through these actions. Obviously, the first action that's of primary importance to the Ways and Means Committee is in the appropriations process to examine and question the agencies and outcome achievements and targets. This clearly is what's known as performance budgeting, what have you. This is certainly most important. You'll notice that in the handouts in back of after page 2, labeled handout number 3, is an excerpt from the legislative results. It's just for your it's a checklist that you might want to use in hearings of basic questions that we and our advisors put together as basic questions to ask an agency. It's just, there's 2 pages. It looks something like this. It's page 9.9-4 in the Legislative Results book. It's just sort of a checklist that you would need to adapt to any particular program you're looking at, asking some of the basic results-oriented questions. So we suggest you may want to take a look at that. I don't have time to go through them right now. They're fairly obvious if you think about them, but it's surprising how seldom agencies are asked these questions. Action 2. Oops. Okay. I'm sorry. Action 2. Then we'll get to that. This is between sessions. Even though you're in a biennium and your major session is this year, the first year of the biennium, you really don't have time to look in depth at programs. You're too busy with all the millions of things you have to do. It's between sessions that hopefully you can have an opportunity to get your subcommittees together to occasionally review at least selected programs. And I think this is something that our advisors and ourselves have been recommending, that between reviews you pick selected programs that are particular concern to you all, to the committee, and have them looked at in more depth and question them about, using perhaps the same set of questions, adapting those as well. And we're going to illustrate another audio that Judy's going to take us through, an example of what this might be done. Now, who's going to be talking? Judy?
This particular segment is from the Performance Review Subcommittee in Louisiana, which does have a performance budgeting system in place. And the hearing is about a nutria eradication program. And apparently you have nutria in Oregon. They're less of a problem than they are in Louisiana. And as you listen to this hearing, you'll hear what they've been trying to do, because nutria do cause coastal damage to the coast of Louisiana. And they're trying to harvest them. The number of nutria that they're trying to harvest and the number of acres that have been damaged are the subject of the discussion. The first person that you'll hear speaking is the Legislative Fiscal Office staff, and they're presenting the background. And then the members of the committee will ask the agency head about the success or lack thereof of the program. Thank goodness for Ken.
These indicators measure the number of acres damaged by nutria and the number of nutria harvested. Despite the department's efforts, nutria population seems to be exceeding the carrying capacity of their habitat, as shown by the indicator measuring the total acres in coastal Louisiana damaged by them. Although there is an increase of 8,000 nutria harvested per year, the prior year actual was 21,000, the year-end actual this year is 29,000, there are several factors responsible for not meeting the target of 120,000 nutria harvested per year. The public is reluctant to accept this product for human consumption. The value of pelts has declined greatly, leaving less motivation for trappers to harvest the fur-bearing animals. The corporate project does provide for an incentive payment for both the trapper and Nutria meat processor. However, over the last 3 years, one processor has participated and has processed approximately 25,000 pounds of Nutria meat for human consumption. In addition to the promotion of Nutria meat for human consumption, Act 552 of the 1990 regular legislative session established a program that provides a subsidy to Nutria trappers to encourage trappers to harvest more Nutria. Landowners, as well as the department, are providing a bounty to the trappers. The program was in place prior to the corporate project and has not been successful due to the lack of trapping effort due to low pelt prices. The $1 incentive is not enough to encourage increased participation.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Philip Bowman, Assistant Secretary for the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, and we'd be happy to respond to any questions you may have.
I'd like you to address the situation. I mean, you know, we still, and I understand that there's some market dynamics here that we can't necessarily control, but we are spending money on a program that doesn't seem to be getting the impact.
Well, at least not the desired impact that we would all like to see it have, but you're absolutely correct. And we're continuing to strive and look for other avenues to increase the economic value of that animal.
So our strategy has been to offer an incentive payment to both the processor and the trapper.
That's correct.
And the processor, from my understand here, after 3 years, we've only had one processor take advantage of it.
Actually, there's been two individuals, but only one at a time. We had one individual in southwest Louisiana the first year we offered that. He declined to participate the second year. We had a gentleman in southeast Louisiana that has now been participating, I think, for 2 years.
Well, any way you look at it, that incentive isn't delivering the people that you need to sell products.
That's correct. And Ms. Winston, if I could interrupt, and we have increased the incentive payment to both the trapper and the processor, and each year we have been in the program.
I think you're making my point then. So with the trapper, it's the same thing. You've offered the incentive, you've raised the incentive, and you still, the demand isn't there.
That's correct.
The demand is not there for the consumption. The demand is not there for the fur.
That's correct.
And your sentence says it appears this strategy will take additional time to develop a demand. It sounds to me it's a strategy we need to maybe dismiss and find another one if we continually try to tweak something where there is no demand.
That's correct.
That therein is my suggestion. We need to drop a strategy that obviously government cannot create the demand.
That
markets have to create the demand, and people don't want to wear nutrient or eat it.
You'll note how the performance information enabled the legislators to target right in on the problem, identify it, and what they decided to do for solution is not listed there, but they were able to see that there was definitely a problem. And one interesting aside is when we were doing one of these presentations in another state, one of our team members had some experience in Africa, and actually in this particular African country, nutria are in high demand as a food product, and they are trying to build up the stock of nutria in the country. And we thought, well, maybe we really ought to connect up Louisiana with this country, and maybe they can work something out.
In trying to develop this disc, we went through all sorts of tapes from many, many states, and it was extremely difficult to find legislators that really were quizzing or just asking agency people about results. It's very rare today, and it still is very rare throughout the United States. And we're hoping is that, at least in Oregon, you change that slant. Now, this next slide, would you look at look at page 4 of the handout behind you. You need to look at it, because I'm going to ask you a question. I wanted you to do a little bit of work here. This is data from New Mexico. This actually happens to be real data from the higher education system. And it'll be labeled Exhibit 1, and the labels are a little bit are in there as well, if you can't see up here. Now, assuming that you are a legislator looking at this data, and you have the higher education people in front of you, does anything hit you as to what you would want to, what data jumps out at you, what would you like to ask that agency? Yes.
Why Campus D only has an 18.3% completion rate within 6 years on indicator number one? That kind of jumps out at you.
Yep.
And also, why is the data on the number of male and female students not available? And why is their minority enrollment so low when you look at what some of the other campuses are?
Okay.
That would be where I
started. Right. And all of those. Now, it's not just the one. Actually, it's the three campuses, DE&F, all have substantially lower rates of completion as well as retention rates.
Yeah.
And there's no question something's wrong. Now, in New Mexico, the ones on the left happen to be what they call research institutions, and the ones on the right are what they call comprehensive institutions. Now, that would explain a little bit of it, but not the large extent to which these are different. And pursuing that issue would be certainly a major issue. And as you also said, the minority enrollment clearly in these three campuses is very low, very much so, and one would want to see what's going on. And it's data such as this that can be enormously powerful to you in looking at the information and making choices and allocations.
On that piece, on
yes.
The
right.
You really want to disaggregate that data down to race, ethnicity, also retention.
Yes. You.
It's not enough to look at enrollment and completion. It's
you're making a wonderful point, which I'm going to get at even more later, that it's vitally important to do more disaggregation of the data to really understand it. Are there certain minority groups that are more affected than others? And in fact, some of your indicators already do this, not too many. The data that you people get, since you've raised this issue now, the data that you're getting are almost all aggregate data for the state as a whole. A major need for you and a major advantage would be to get data broken out in different ways. Now, in fact, the Oregon Progress Board, is there a yellow document there? I'm just curious as to.
Is this the one here?
Yeah.
Aren't you
just
that?
Thank
that's
you.
Mine.
Thank you. I know. How many of you, does any of you recognize this? This is a Oregon project. This is the county data book. It's November 2003. They do it every 2 years. I think they're preparing another one. But this is the one place where, at least on the benchmarks, they do have data by each county, which it seems to me is extraordinarily important for you all in looking at the data. And for the most part, the data that you're getting are not broken out geographically, and also in many human services and many other services, employment services, breakouts by gender, by minority group, are extremely important. Household composition and other characteristics are very important. And I would encourage you, and we all encourage you to, as appropriate, to look for that sort of breakout data. Now, action three occurs when proposals come in at any point in time for new programs, new policies. Outcome, the performance information we're talking about is not only intended for use for budgeting purposes, any policy formulation purposes, it should be the same issues. You should be concerned what results will be affected by the change in policy. Here, the suggestion is to, if someone proposes a new program or policy, at least look at the past data, outcome data, to see what the story was. Does it justify the proposal? And if you go ahead with the authorization for the new program, at that time provide for the provision feedback to you all of regular outcome information to be included at regular intervals in the performance reporting. Action 4, Gary mentioned incentives in Florida, and Texas also has legislation. Here we're not talking about requiring the use of, but the encouraging or supporting the use of incentives in which results are one of the primary characteristics, one of the primary criteria in the incentive. Both monetary and non-monetary incentives can be used. I just want to caution you that monetary incentives, they're both expensive and you don't have a lot of money, extra money floating around. However, they also have the problem that they can be counterproductive if you're not careful with in how you formulate them. I'm going to show you a couple of examples of these. The next one is from Louisiana. This is in the Louisiana legislation. The legislature has actually legislated the opportunity to use certain types of incentives. And these are triggered when a reward or penalty, when the agency or program exceeds 5% in either direction, either worse than or better than the target. And here are the potential awards that can be used. Notice that some of them are non-monetary, the increased authority to transfer funds, approve small purchases, add employee training. Those are non-monetary for the most part. Also, under penalties, are very interesting if one of the penalties is to increase the performance reporting, which is a very clever thing that's been used in Florida, I know, for in some agencies that can be used, as well as the requirement for an audit. Here's where the audit requirement can snap in if they're not meeting targets, another corrective action. At the extreme, of course, the last one, the committee can recommend restructuring or elimination of the work. The next example is, I'm sorry. This is from Oklahoma, and Oklahoma has had this program, Invoke Rehab, for training. It was a nationally award program, as a matter of fact, which divided the payments schedule based on the timing and condition of the placement. The first couple are prior to placement. The third bullet, they got 10% of the fee for job placement, then four weeks later for another 20%, another few weeks, another 10 to 17 weeks, next 20%, and about 33%, 30 weeks later, the rest of it came if the customer still was in employment. So they basically based the payments on achieving jobs and job retention. Very, very good. Next one. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, New Mexico, this is a brand new thing. This is a proposal that was just proposed in the fall. I just put it together from the proposal that was given from the higher education, the Commission on Higher Education actually is proposing this to the legislature and who's been reviewing this. It's a bonus plan that they're suggesting. It's similar to the trouble you had before, which we showed the problem with the campuses having different graduation placement rates. This was the idea was to put a bonus relating to Pell students, those who are low-income students, based upon retention, based upon graduation, the first two bullets. The third was intended to reward any situation where a client, a low-income person, completed a degree and then went on to very soon into a graduate, into a college baccalaureate program. And the fourth element of this plan was to provide a bonus for improvement from the previous year. Now, this is just an abstract and full plan. It's very complicated, this plan. Had to be very careful with it. But it's a very clever piece of business. Actually, I skipped around a little bit. Action 5 is related to employee. We're dealing with incentives both to employees and to contractors. We talked about the Oklahoma case already. Let's go to the slide 20, which is the North Carolina's adoption program. This is another example of contracting out to nonprofit organizations for adoptions. And again, the payment schedule was based on the achievement of certain results. That's what a performance contract is. It's when you, inside the contract, you have certain targets for results. And you build those in, and it's extraordinarily powerful. The type of performance, probably the first performance contracts that I know of in government, in state government, has been, does anybody want to hazard a guess? Where's the performance early performance contracts? Pardon? Transportation. What was it?
We had incentives for computing projects on time and even under schedule.
Exactly. That was probably the first one that has been used fairly widely. Bonuses and penalties for exceeding meeting the schedule completion times for major construction, road, or bridge projects, usually. But from that, people have emerged into a whole series of service contracts where this can be used. That can be very powerful. Now, the next slide, you'll have to look at in your handouts. It's labeled page 5. It looks like this. It's too much to put on a slide. This is actually a performance grant. It involves the relationship between the state agency, in this case the health department, and the women's preventive health program in that department, and the county governments. And they basically... This is not a strong monetary incentive program, but it is a very good incentive program. What they do is that every year they rank and rate the results on these four, in this case there's four indicators here related to women's preventive health. They're shown for each county, and they rate and rank each county. Now notice that this is on the left-hand column at Central. They, in North Carolina, in order to make for fairer comparisons, they group the counties into four clusters. This central one is the large urban areas, and then they have three geographical areas, and counties are compared with each of those four geographical areas or sector areas of the state. Now the incentive was that counties that received very low program rankings for two consecutive years, and I'm quoting here, will be subject to increased state involvement in the development of their agenda and deliverables. And they said that as long as the county makes a good faith effort to provide those deliverables, they would not take money away. They would not assess a financial penalty, as long as that was done, even if the ranking was not very good. So it was a... They also provided technical assistance to counties that were having trouble. So it was intended to be a constructive, not just a threatening type of contract. Finally, Action 6. I'm sure it's important to all legislators is communication with your constituents. We take it on faith that your constituents will be much more interested in data on results than on process and inputs. That is extremely important. And this is where I was going to talk about the issue of tailoring the data to your own constituents. And that means more emphasis on the breakout type of data by county, by your district, by gender, by race, ethnicity, by family income group, whatever major characteristic of those families. And here the problem is to get that data from the agency. And many of the data that that the agencies are collecting and provided to you are sort of automatically probably collected by counties. So in many cases, it should be available. Department of Health, for example, I'm sure is able to provide such data. I would think that many of the human service programs should be able to provide data broken out by county or by certain of these other characteristics. The final slide is from actually taken off a website. This is the state of Vermont, and it's a map. You can't see much of the data on there. So you can see better in your handout, but the point is, this is presentation, again, a breakout by county, which is going to be much more interesting to the citizens of Vermont than having just one figure for the whole state. And what's very nice about this type of chart, you know, these maps are really very, very exciting stuff. The darker the area, the worse the condition usually is. And that's what's the case here. The numbers in black, the lower number is 37 teenage pregnancies per 1,000. The one up above is 30, just for your information. So information and presentations like this can be very important when you're dealing and communicating with your citizens. And if you're the type of legislators that provide reports to your citizens, having some of these types of charts and graphs should be very powerful in showing progress or lack of it. The one final thing is that when when the state's not meeting targets, the problem is also to tell people what you're trying to do to improve things. That's a good help. Any questions before we here it is. Go to the next, to Anita.
How do you prevent the agencies from totally explaining away what performance
with? Well, the problem always has been these explanations, some of them are nothing. They're excuses and lame. The people reading those explanations have to make judgments about whether they make any sense or not. I mean, there's no miracle here. To some extent, you may want to require in-depth studies to be done if it's really a very, very important program. The agency may not have a good explanation often for this. I mean, remember, not all these things are clear-cut as to why bad results are happening. And in this case, you may want to require the agency to come back and do some sort of in-depth study and come back to the legislature with the explanation later. Often, that's not the case. But those explanations are just so important to follow up on. And as the Nutria thing, you really need to dig into that to find out what's going on, what to do. Yes, sir.
I apologize, I had to leave. I'm really intrigued by the action for it to provide incentives. I'm a believer we've got these large agencies and bureaucracies, and they should be able to manage themselves effectively, but you have to be able to put something there to make them do that. I think incentives to do that and punishments. Is there other, I read the example real fast that you have here, are there a lot of other examples of how states have done that successfully?
They have not been pulled together. There's a few in the textbook in the book. I don't know whether Anita may have one or two that she may be able to sprinkle in. Gary mentioned I think the community college one. A lot of this. Keep in mind that the focus on results is fairly new in the United States at the state level. It's still, even though performance data has been around for a long time, this approach is fairly new, so there's not been that much. States have suggestion systems, most of them, which have some sort of incentive. Those are traditional. But the things we're talking about here are more dramatic and are still fairly rare.
Our 50% of our state budget is K-12, and there's nothing in the 12 K-12 budget based upon the center. It's all put into the number of students in the city.
Well, that's an opportunity to
distribution formula that doesn't recognize merit or achievement in any of the past.
you know, one very powerful, I'm a believer in, for government, I don't know that monetary incentives for individual employees is particularly that good. I think government people are motivated somewhat differently. I really do believe that. And so one non-monetary award, which is dirt cheap, is recognition. Recognition. Have awards for the school district, the county, that's really performing well. And you people go out, and the representative from that area and the senator go out there and lead the congratulations, and they cost a little bit of a few dollars for the party. But it's a marvelous, I think, way to do things. And I think employees appreciate that, yes.
That survey of states and what's done, and recognition is really important, and what's tied to it is like the chart we have our handout, it's where you get bragging rights for tickets in schools, you have school districts in schools, so that those that are doing well, these guys circulate and they talk to each other, and who wants to be on the bottom of the list? And so there's kind of an inherent incentive to move ahead if there's open comparisons.
And one of the things we've done in Florida with what we call our A-plus plan is we grade schools using basically A through F. And there's incentive for being an A school because it's not a lot of money. It's $200 or $300 per teacher, and then the teachers can decide how to divide that up for bonuses or for supplies or technology or what have you. I can't say it hasn't been controversial. The metrics of that are always, you know, what should you count and things like that. The system's been developing now for 5 years, so it's much stronger now than it was, but it's still, well, if I've got low-performing kids in my school, you know, I could be doing a great job with them, but I'm not going to get them up here because they came in down here. We're still developing that, but it's been a pretty powerful tool because, you know, the schools that are down there at F will do everything they can to get off the F list, and we provide them extra help and things like that. The schools that are up there as A's really like that recognition. So you don't have to put a whole lot of money into that. I mean, the testing, which we've got to do with No Child Left Behind now, and there's ways I think you can tweak that to give you sort of a bottom line report card, which goes to the schools and goes to the public. Yeah.
Yes. Well, supposedly, I mean, normally the reaction in general in the field has been that performance-based budgeting moves away from micromanaging. I mean, that's supposedly one of the big advantages. You say, I will be concerned about results. You've got to do it, and you have more flexibility in what you do. In performance contracting, that's key, is to give the contractor more leeway in what they do. You don't specify. If you have a contract, some of the common contracts have been services, you know, like cleaning and maintenance. And then you can check with trained observer, what we call trained observer ratings, to test the condition of the buildings and the streets around the states or the cities, or the vehicles, and you can do that very easily. And now, Anita?
I'm going to switch gears a little bit and tell you about Texas and the kind of work I think that probably you work with somebody like me every day or when you're in session. I work for the Texas Legislative Budget Board, which is a standing committee, a standing joint committee, as perhaps this one is that we're working with you today. It is a 10-member board, 5 House members, 5 senators. It is a co-chair situation. Where you have, it's co-chaired by the Lieutenant Governor, who presides over the Senate and co-chairs with the Speaker of the House. It is by law composed then of the 2 funding chairmen, the Senate Finance Chair and the House Appropriations. And on the House side, Ways and Means, the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, as in Texas at any rate, that's where a tax bill must come from, is from the House. And then on the Senate side, we have Senate State Affairs. And then the 2 remaining members of our board are appointed by the Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker. This is a joint standing committee. We, as a staff, we're probably one of the larger staffs among the states. There's about 140 of us that serve these members. We have a variety of duties. By law, the LBB is who we refer to ourselves. The LBB, the director of the LBB, must develop and provide to the members by the 10th day of its session an appropriation bill. And the mechanics of how that happens is we internally are given guidance by that board in what we refer to as parameters. For example, it may be we're going to fund the estimated enrollment growth in our Texas public schools and in our institutions of higher education. Another parameter might be to estimate and to allow for growth in the Medicaid program for the entitlement component of that program, the CHIP program, et cetera, et cetera. So we're given a variety of parameters, and then in the summer and the fall prior to a session, and our legislature meets for 140 days every other year, we prepare that bill. Different boards, I've worked for the Legislative Budget Board for 14 years, and I've seen many different changes. I've worked under many different members, and they have different styles. Each committee has a different style. When I first came to the LBB, we would prepare that bill under the parameters and then present each component of that bill in an open session and allow for public testimony before it was filed. In the last 10 years, it's been more, here are the directives, please do these things, check in with us, let us know what the cost of this bill is becoming, and then the two chairmen, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee and the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, take the bill and file it in identical form on the House side and the Senate side. And that may be one of the biggest differences, I mean, you would have to tell me, but as I've talked with other states, is we are not a governor-driven budget. It is a legislative-driven budget, state budget. So given those parameters, I'd like to talk a little bit about then what my role would be in working with the members. It would be not only the members of our 10-member board, but then staffing. We staff the appropriations process throughout the whole process. We actually make that bill, and it is one large General Appropriations Act for all functions of government. And my role in the last three sessions has been the lead for the House side. Internally, we work both House and Senate, and we stay that way until we go into session. And then during session, I stay with the House side, go through the markup process, the hearing process, actually prepare and develop and deliver that bill. And then in our state, it's traditional for it to go to conference and for the House and Senate to work it out ultimately. In terms of performance measures, those are all part of the bill as introduced. And since we've been sitting a long time, I think I'm going to take the approach of pointing out some of the things in my handout that maybe would be something that would be of interest to you just to see how our state does that. If you can turn to page 4A in the blue handout, and the way it was compiled would be, sometimes we have to hold it up in that manner. But on 4A, you'll see this is the actual bill pattern, as we refer to it, for the Fifth Court of Appeals, which is in Dallas. And our particular bill pattern shows the method of finance at the top. We also allow for the members and the readers to know how much this bill pattern contains in terms of the money this entity has access to. And then you see that we identify the number of employees, the salaries of the top or the exempt positions. And then you see this particular court just has one line item appropriation. That's not true for a much larger agency. And then for information, you'll see just the assumptions built into these costs. And moving down to the bottom, though, you'll see the performance measure targets. And you'll see that there's a statement in every bill pattern that is to the effect that it's the intent of the legislature that these appropriations be utilized in an efficient and effective manner. And then underneath that, if you turn the page, you'll see this particular entity has three performance measures in the appropriations bill that sets targets. In this case, and it would be true for all of our courts, these are three standard measures. Their clearance rate, the average percent of cases that are submitted but not disposed of within a year, or the average percent of cases filed but not disposed of within 2 years. So that's just an example of the bill pattern and the targets embedded in the bill for this for the courts. If you turn the page, you'll see that there's a much larger agency that we provide an example for you, the Commission on Environmental Quality. This would be in the natural resource area. I would assume that you would have a similar agency. You'll see in this particular category, we're on page 4C, they have many more methods of finance and many more items of appropriation. But then going to the focus of today, if you go on 4D, you'll see the performance measures take several pages, but they are targeting things that most states are struggling with, at least in pockets of our state we are. The nitrous oxide emissions, the pollution, reduction in pollution, these are all outcome measures. Percent of our surface water meeting or exceeding water standards. These are actual targets that are in the bill. Each agency has targets. I guess being in truth and budgeting, the legislature at this point, we do not have targets in the bill for. But most other agencies we do. And they're in the bill. And for a practical matter, we provide information or backup for our members as they are working with the agencies in testimony to give context to these. And I'd like to turn you then to an assessment. If you go to page, that's 6A, the Texas Education Agency, I tried to pick examples that you would have a parallel agency. In Texas, this is one of our largest areas of the budget. This, although we have a biennial budget, this particular example goes for fiscal year 2004, and its budget is $15.2 billion for that year. You'll see that we provide for the members a quick snapshot of that year, the methods of finance that this agency has within its financial access, the number of employees. If you look at that, we try to give a five-year history for certain components. And in this case, you'll see that back in 2000, they had 804 employees, which was somewhat rising until fiscal year 2004. And just somewhat earlier, I mentioned that we had some budget challenges. This is one agency whose administrative functions. You'll see that that cap, which is set by the legislature, went from 860 to 766. And as the year completed, you'll see the agency actually came in at 647 employees. So this is just one example of showing that history. Another area that in our state many of the members are interested in are the contracts. Increased emphasis on contracting for services has been an emphasis our state's been looking at. So we provide a snapshot of their top contracts. And you'll see that some of them are quite sizable. The first one at $237.8 million for some computer systems. And then the smallest one we show you is an educational testing service and how much we are paying for that service. Other components of this review that are provided for the members are some of the recent reports or audits done on this agency. And we do a quick little summary. Generally, when a committee meets, the full documents are provided, but this gives a high-level overview. And then on the following page, you'll see that we go through and select just a handful of the measures, show the history of the targets that were set by the legislature in the Appropriations Act, and then the actual performance reported by that agency. In general, we try to pick outcome measures so that you get a higher-level view of what the agency is doing. And if we just look at one, if I were to pick the second one down, the percent of students included in the accountability system, you'll see that the target actually was probably set lower in 04 because of the financial conditions, but the agency actually exceeded that target and came in with 89%. And then you'll see on the left side of that page, some context is provided for understanding of the indicator and what it might mean. many times this document serves as a reminder or a getting up to speed or up to date with what the agency's doing and reporting, and then provides enough information that members ask questions and go from there. Performance measures have been in our Appropriations Act since 1991. We have taken different approaches, different times. In fact, the bill pattern I showed you a few minutes ago is new this year. It's the same information, just rearranged. We have the method of finance at the top of the bill. There were the co-chairs or the chairman decided this time they want to see the money first, then where it was going, and then the performance. So, you know, those are somewhat cosmetic, but can be very important if, depending on your viewpoint of what people want to see. Another point that I would mention, I believe one of you asked earlier, how can you rely on the data? And that's really one of the biggest underlying challenges. One of the things that we've spent a lot of time on over the last 10 or 15 years is trying to get very concrete definitions. If you've got a measure, you've got to have a standard by which there is a definition for that data. You know, where is that data housed? All the different components, so then it can be audited. Without that component, an auditing is very difficult. And often in the first 5 or 6 years, those were often the problems. The agency was reporting data, but it didn't match the definition. And I wouldn't say we're perfect. You never get perfect. But I think that those are the kinds of things that we have increased accuracy on. I would also say, and it would be the same, I would imagine, in your states, the areas of the budget where the federal government is more dominant or more a provider of funding, they often also have standards and measures that have to be met, whether it's in the workforce area, the old AFDC, now TANF, work participation rates, or reporting to the federal government on Medicaid. All of these, in those areas of the budget, we're probably stronger in both our definitions and in our use and our understanding, because there's a multiple level of need to get and justify to the feds and keep our auditing trails and our use of money clear there. We try to the extent possible to piggyback on what the feds need and make sure that we're embedding it in our state system and reviewing that information. Let me stop now and see if any of you have any questions that you may have.
How do you avoid the grade inflation tendency with agencies and frankly with educational institutions to meet their performance targets? Does it get back to your definition? Set these definitions up for them?
You ask about how to avoid inaccuracies in the reporting or inflation. Yes, it's that, but also we do have quarterly reporting by the agencies into our. We have a repository data database that they report online to, and that is monitored each quarter. In fact, I've got an example of that, and I think it's over. You know, from a practical standpoint, it's over time and use of these measures. At times, having the audit of those, you know, a sampling of those, and familiarity both with the agency and with legislative staff or the legislative members. There's no one simple solution to that, but use of them makes a difference. If they're used, I think the understanding or accountability is implicit in that, and the system gets stronger. Yes, ma'am.
Both you and your colleague from Florida have put heavy emphasis on centralized collection of data. And in your systems, is there any part of state government that is outside those parameters? And let me be specific. In the state of Oregon, our university system has not used our budgeting system and doesn't necessarily connect up at all points. When you're collecting data in your states, are all agencies and all parts of government required to submit data in the same format and in the same time frames?
I'll respond, and then Gary can respond as well. It took us a while to get higher ed and to get the courts into the system, but now both of those systems are in and reporting online. I will say that in higher education, they report less frequently due to the nature of a quarterly wouldn't necessarily give us the enrollment or the information. So they do report at a different interval, but now they are all online. I think the community colleges were the last ones to come online.
In Florida, everybody has measures, but some of them are better than others. So we have measures for the court system. They're not great. The higher education measures aren't great. We have good ones, I think, for instruction, but for the other university missions of research and public service, because those are more amorphous things to measure, no one's really satisfied with those. But everybody has measures, but I mean, the usefulness of them for oversight probably varies a bit across the board, even after working on this for a while.
Yes, sir. Okay. That's probably true. As I understand your question, in general, it's how does our state and its staff work, and what are our resources? We have, as I said earlier, our staffing level is about 140 staff. They are not all. Yes. But I respect the work that you're saying. That's right. That's right. And I'll try to drill down in broad categories how that staff is made up. We, in the last decade, have picked up a number of responsibilities that we have not always had. Probably 60 of that 140 are frontline budget analysts. And we have another core, probably 40, that are working in more of an audit function, not necessarily auditors, but we, in the last few years, have picked up the responsibilities to review school districts, to go into a school district, oversee their management and other practices, you know, the size of their book holdings and a number of other indicators, and give feedback to those school districts. That was transferred legislatively to us in the last legislature. We had the similar function in higher education to review the institutions of higher education and try to identify where all their money resources are and to also oversee how they're doing and provide feedback. Those two functions are more, let's sit down, see what you have, and see if we can't find more efficient and better ways to do your business. Another new function for us was transferred in the last legislative session from the Comptroller's Office, and it's the Texas Performance Review. It's an activity where we review all of state agencies' operations, and we don't review all of them each time, but we look for areas of efficiencies and a way to change the way the state is doing business. In this case, this particular, we produced our first report. It came out just a few weeks ago. The board set a $3 billion target for us in general revenue to look for either revenue generation, savings, or changes in the way activities are done. And again, that's a new function for us. You've probably read about that from before. And that particular team probably has 20 maybe members. And then we have a great depth in terms of programming staff and computer resources, because we do are responsible for also writing all the fiscal notes for each piece of legislation that's introduced and a fiscal note for each iteration of that bill. And the same budget staff are writing those fiscal notes, but it takes we have a lot of automated systems to get the data from the agencies when the bill is filed and then for us to analyze and then to electronically disperse. So those are the kinds of resources that we have.
Yeah, Florida's going to be big, too. Let me warn you on that. Yeah, we're a fairly good-sized state. Our budget's around $60 billion annually. We have an annual session. We have appropriation staff, pardon? General funds around $24-25 billion. So, we have fiscal staff who staff the appropriation committees. My office has around 80 folks in it. We were pulled out of our Auditor General's office. The Auditor General used to have what they called a program audit division who did management reviews of agencies. That was pulled out of that office to set up OPAGA about 10 years ago when the state started really getting more into performance budgeting because they wanted us to be working more closely with the legislature and more closely with this type of information rather than management reviews of agencies. So I think that there's some opportunities to task staff from the state auditor staff to do some of this stuff. Steal staff when you can. You may have more resources than just your current staff that you could task towards this type of stuff.
As a member, following up on Richard's question, how does the number of your staff compare with the number of fiscal staff in the governor's office or your Department of Administrative Services?
Governor's office, the budget folks, I think they're up about 50 right now. So.
We also have more. I'm guessing, but I believe they have about 30 staff.
Are they responsible for the governor's office? The executive branch, how many staff? I mean, when you go beyond the governor's office.
Oh, to all the affected agencies?
We have a separate Department of Administrative Services, which is outside the governor's office. It's just a lot of the budget.
We don't have that mechanism. In Texas, it would be the governor's office and their staff. And then it would be each executive agency's got its chief financial officers and budget staff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether it's relevant or not, but Texas is similarly sized to Florida. We do the biennial budget. The bill is introduced. It's $134.4 billion in all funds for the 2 year and about $64 billion in general revenue.
In Florida, we're similar. You've got the legislative staff, you've got governor's office staff, and every agency is going to have budget staff as well. So,
of course, nothing that we have said here is dependent upon size. Oregon can do all of this probably just as good as these two states with that legislature.
I think our staff do a remarkable.
They do.
We have two analysts devoted to 55% of the general fund.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the key is to try to be creative on what resources are out there that could help do this. Obviously, you don't have 50 people to get into the performance measures. I think you have to be really selective in terms of what to look at. I think you have to use this as a warning system to target the resources you've got. If you could do, more in-depth reviews on four or five programs a year, which were of high concern to the legislature, and look around and see what resources maybe you could task the state audit folks, even though that's an executive branch, to say, we want you to give us reports on these three things, then that would give you some resources that you could use. And Georgia does sort of similar stuff with theirs, with their office. So.
How can legislators help the staff?
Well, in Florida, what we like to do is, in terms of working with the legislature, is have an ongoing conversation that we've got research capacity. We want to be looking at the issues that are a concern to you. So I think that knowing what you're interested in, having the time then to go out and look at that and having an ongoing conversation. Here's what we're finding so far. Is this addressing your needs? Is there something else that we could look at for here? I think that works better than just, you guys figure out something to do in the interim, and then we'll sit down with you when we come back and talk about it. So I think that ongoing interaction to strategically use the resources you've got is going to be key.
That's similar to us. I think it's... we view our role as supporting the needs. So to the extent we know the needs and the direction, and we are nonpartisan staff and often try to anticipate, given you know, the many issues that are out there at large that are facing all states, and try to anticipate areas also that our members would gain insights and be ready to tackle a particular issue. One example right now is Medicare Part D. You know, a lot of analysis has been done by our office and different approaches, because the states as employers have decisions that have to be made, or at least our state has not made those decisions yet. And we feel that will be one segment where we were trying to help get our members ready. But it also, sometimes it comes the other way. There are topics that members indicate to us they would like investigated and show high interest. Yes, sir.
Did any performance highlights like on 6B and interpret the information on statistical analysis legislative is going to come with a huge range of experience? You have an expertise in that. How, is that a difficult thing for you to do? From a stats viewpoint, how in depth are you getting involved in that statistical analysis?
In our case, it's a challenge. But it's something I think our analysts actually enjoy doing. They enjoy seeing, given the resources provided to an agency, what have the results and outcomes been. And also it helps us in doing the analysis to know where the budget needs may or may not lie, or where problems may or may not lie. And sometimes even statutory issues come up in this review of the data, where a statute may have had one, or we thought one intended consequence, and there's a wrinkle that needs to be addressed. So we do it in this large format once a year. We don't do it quarterly. We have done it we have done it at the request or direction of an interim committee. There have been times we did it, you know, each year or every 6 months. But we found that the way our cycle goes, that second year you're in session, and so it's really, we do one at the end of each fiscal year, but when you're going between biennium, there's less use of the previous biennium. You know, it's kind of like we finished that when we just passed a new budget. But we find the analysis useful for our own monitoring and oversight of the budgets.
It seems to me the interpretation part of
it is really
crucial.
Mm-hmm.
All that's
That's true.
Keep in mind that regardless of the size of the state, legislating for results is additional workload conceptually on the staff. So what's necessary is what's happening, I think, in Texas and Florida, but also with places like New Mexico and Louisiana, which are more in your ballgame. What's happening is the nature of their work is shifting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you all don't, the workload you impose on them and the questions you ask of them is going to be very important here. And if they shift more to the results-oriented questions as opposed to some of the more detailed line item type of issues, that will help, I suspect, your LFO offices. That's right. Absolutely.
But I could give you a concrete example that happened yesterday in a House Appropriations Committee hearing. The agency that we have for Child Protective Services was testifying on a variety of issues, and we have some challenges in our state. It's a tough policy area, and there many times it's difficult to align the resources and solutions. But in the course of it, one of the members came back and asked me to print out from our system what their performance measures had been, and so they could see what the targets had been. And this, her particular focus in this hearing was the cases per worker, and we do have an item on that. And they actually, in this case, are going to do, within their work, they're going to try to work with the agency to develop some new indicators to more align with some areas that they'd like to know about that the measures aren't capturing. Even, you know, you can get one thing, but you may be looking for another. Yes. In Texas, for last biennium and this, and in some years past, the way the House works, the House Appropriations Committee is 29 members, and all but the chair and the vice chair are what we are CBOs, the committee's budget and oversight members for a particular other standing committee, say public health or human services or transportation, so that each of those standing committees has someone on the appropriations committee, and there should be a two-way street. Is that getting okay?
Yeah, I think Florida is somewhat similar to the House. What the House does is they have councils which try to bring together substantive and appropriation committee chairs sort of at a higher level. So you'd have substantive committees, you'd have appropriation committees, and then you've got a council that tries to coordinate the efforts of those two. In the Senate, because it's much smaller, 40 members, then a lot of the members who will be on appropriation committees will also be members of the respective substantive committee.
How long is it taking you to feel comfortable in your states with the outcome measures that are fairly consistent? Questions that came up in our subject meeting this morning is that fine balance between really getting some good outcomes and changing outcomes every session where there's no accountability.
The stability and the indicators.
Yes. I think it takes several years, and for a couple of reasons. One is that this requires agencies to set up measurement systems to track stuff they haven't tracked before. And particularly in Florida, you know, agencies could track their money. They tracked it by organization, entity, bureaus, divisions, things like that, but they never really track results. It took them a while to develop systems to do that. I think it's important to give them flexibility and understand that, well, the first year we'll give you what we have. It's not really what anybody wants, but next year we're going to move here, and the third year we'll move there, and maybe after 4 years we'll start getting trend information that everybody will feel comfortable for, and we just have to give the time for that system to mature. And I think that's sort of it's frustrating because you feel at times that agencies are getting off the hook because, well, you didn't look good at that measure, so you changed the measure. So I think there needs to be an ongoing conversation between your staff and the agencies and to drive that. And I think that one thing in terms of maximizing the use of staff, it's important with this system, particularly if you have a limited number of staff who can help it, is to set it up right at the beginning. One of the challenges we had in Florida was we didn't have a good driver for this for a while, and so agencies would feel that, well, depending who's in this meeting is the type of system that you want. And, you know, for your staff to have, okay, this is what we want your measures to look like. Here's how we want that reported in a user-friendly way for us, so we don't have to spend the next 2 weeks, you know, consolidating this information that comes in 15 different formats, you know, that we can pull it all into an Access or an Excel spreadsheet, and then we can just do the analysis. We're not going to do the compilation. So I think that, you know, with limited staff, the more that you can make the system user-friendly for the folks who are using it, then the more useful it's going to be, because you don't have to spend all your time just getting the numbers down. You've got the numbers to start with, and then you just do the analysis.
We've had a similar experience, and to a large extent, we try not to change measures because you'll never get that long-term look. There are times we actually run two parallel measures for a while. If there's been a proposal to change it or tweak it to a different direction, but you run the old one too, so that, because it's usually the same data, it may be just a different slice at it. And other times the members have gotten very involved. They have in our state in higher education and set, graduation rates within 4 years as a measure that goes across all institutions. 4 years, 6 years, tracking the cross between a student starting in one place and leaving another, and some of these that try to get accountability and also move the state in a direction they want to see, and more graduates, more people entering and successfully exiting higher education.
The federal government has gone along, is heavily involved in setting a lot of these indicators. I mean, Anita's ex-governor went to the federal government and did something up there, and he has really continued this focus, regardless of the politics of it. He has continued the internal focus on results. There are lots of areas which are fairly stable. I mean, for many years, your departments have been running environmental indicators, child support indicators, education indicators, road condition corrections, with our fairly recognized national measures. And those should not have to be tweaked too much. I mean, there may be some variations, but there should be a reasonable amount of stability in a lot of those key indicators. So while you do have a lot of areas where you're playing around with, and those are going to be a continuing source until you stabilize a bit. but you also should have a core set of pretty good ones that should be fairly stable and comparable to other states that are like your state.
The problem with what we do now, the National Recognized Standards out of the Progress Book, we set the goal of where we want to get to. It's some kind of a morphy, warm, and fuzzy goal. And then we try to measure along the path of us getting there. Where, you know, we can measure the inputs pretty good, at least in terms of money, programs. The outputs we have more difficult, you know, a lot more difficulty measuring and getting to that goal. And then where I think it really breaks down is what are the external factors outside of our control that influence those outputs, and how do we analyze those external factors on those outputs, assuming we've gotten a good methodology? How do we know, you know, that, take your measure, the, you know, roads, that we had the worst winter in 30 years, you know, 4 years in a row, Child Protective Services, unemployment, you know, went through the roof, and the new designer drug mess, you know, ran through the state. How do we interpret those external variables when we're sitting down to what you're trying to get us to, what we all want to do, make rational appropriation decisions?
Well, I think that performance measures aren't going to give you all the answers, but they will help you identify what the questions are sometimes. You know, I think that in terms of saying teenage pregnancy went down, you know, 0.5% because we put posters up or something like that, it's never going to get you there. But it will say, here's what the trend is. And at some point, you may identify that, you know, based on our various approaches to this problem, you know, the external forces are so powerful that there's really little, very little we can do here, so why are we continuing to spend money on it? Or, this is important, but we can recognize we're only going to have this type of an impact on this. But I think that when you see a measure and it's going bad or something, you know, then saying, well, yeah, the road went bad. I mean, we had a terrible winter, so the road conditions went down last year. Well, the next year, if you have a better winter, then it should be back up. And that helps you sort of identify the blips on that. So I think the trend information is important. You know, it's not going to say that, you know, based on this information, then you need to increase your appropriation 1.3% to keep us here, because there's always external factors out there. But it does help you identify and have the discussion of, you know, what's going on here. You know, if we had a great year, is it because the agency had a great year, or because, you know, we had a great winter, or, you know, what's going on here that we need to then see if the agency has a reasonable explanation for it.
So, Ben, a subset of what you just raised too is the using the shifting measures that we can't quite get alighted on as an excuse for agency performance. I mean, I've discovered it already, having had the privilege of sitting in on the same budget now 3 sessions in a row. There's been 3 different heads of the agency, and it's sort of blame the dead guy syndrome. Mm-hmm. We'd have performed, except that guy's gone. And to somehow institutionalize these performance measures so that they become agency performance measures, and you can't use external factors like an agency head departs or unanticipated bad weather to nullify the need to do the reporting and the need to do an analysis, even if it's a negative analysis.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yes. Yes, sir.
How do you define the performance measures in terms of people consciously working on them and not resisting them, when what we see at the legislature is literally the upper layers of management? And to give like 2 examples, our Department of Human Services, not even including outside contractors, that's about 10,000 FTEs, and your favorite agency, the Oregon Department of Transportation, has about 5,000 FTEs, so that you actually get, I mean, you have to change total climate within the agency, total nature of how they deal about that culture.
Yeah. That's a great question. And the real problem in the United States, and I include the federal government, even though you have the president pushing this stuff, is the penetration inside the government and how far down it goes. That's been our big problem in how to do it. Now, some managers, and it really starts at the top and goes down. We've been pushing and encouraging what we call how are we doing sessions, where a manager meets with his staff and reviews the latest performance report. That's more useful in the executive branch if it's done more frequently than annually, which is not timely. But you know, quarterly reporting, which is fairly common in government, you meet annually, you meet quarterly. Mayor O'Malley in Baltimore has something called CityStat program, where he reviews each of these agencies on a regular basis, and he looks at the data, the latest performance data and workload data, and he actually quizzes the agency people. And believe me, that gets down into penetration. Some things like that where, but you've got to get down, and the changing the culture is always a big problem here. Part of it is to avoid being destructive and being, I've always tried to avoid the term evaluation when we talk about these systems, because that's a threatening term. I mean, it depends, you want to be constructive. And part of the dilemma, everybody down the line fears that's could be used to hammer them over the head by the legislature and what have you. And it has to be done constructively. That's a nice thing to say. Making and implementing is the problem, of course. But
in Texas, at times, the presiding officers, well, each interim, they do assignments to different committees or set up new committees to study areas. And monitoring performance measures and their implementation have many times been part of that charge, where an agency heads do come forward and talk to the funding committees and identify. And often it's through that forum that the members got a better sense of why it's working here and doesn't work in another agency. And many times it's exactly as was mentioned. It's whether or not that agency head uses them internally and uses them as communication and as management style.
Yeah, I think that's key. In Florida, the agencies that have done the best job of it had really entrepreneurial agency heads who viewed this as an opportunity for them to improve their operations. And they pushed it down and they managed using the performance information. And our Department of Revenue, I mean, people hated the Department of Revenue before that they started doing this. I mean, it was considered to be user hostile to citizens, a black hole, snotty to the legislature, things like that. And we've had a series of agency heads now that for at least 10 or 12 years have really used this to manage their operations and have pushed it down, have used core cost mapping to streamline the operations, make them more user-friendly. And one of the real advantages that they got out of this was that the legislature started trusting them because they knew they were doing a good job. So, you know, in terms of, well, you're asking for this, we'll give it to you because we have confidence in you, versus this agency, you know, we're really going to question everything that you do because we don't have any confidence in you. So I think that there's intrinsic rewards of doing this in terms of, well, we'll sort of assume that you're telling us the truth instead of we're assuming that you're lying.
Another element are you. I mean, we continually hear the executive branch people, I've heard this at the federal level as well as state level, say that the legislature is not interested, so why should we be interested? To the extent that you all start pressing on these sorts of issues, you're going to help the management, assuming they want to be helped, or you're going to encourage the management to pass it down the line. And, I mean, when they bring in people to assist at these hearings, they'll hear the legislator reaction. And the legislator is only asking about the cost issues and the local process issues. They'll say, well, why should we be doing this? A lot of the measurement work today is done strictly for accountability, not for management purposes, because nobody's taking it seriously at the upper level. So you have a major function.
I think he's had a question for a while. Sorry.
Citizen involvement, community involvement. One of the things I see is the agency comes in and says, this is very good, for instance, the Department of Human Resources. This is the best program to have, and I go and talk to my social worker, and she has a case full of 150, 200 people, and says, this is going to work. So how do you handle that when they come in and tell us that the agency is, you know, their power and their money is there, and then you've got this poor individual worker out there, a citizen who says, this is my issue. Do you have any sense of that? Did the citizen's comments really make any difference?
I think they do. I think often that's opened up a forum for a member such as yourself to then have a dialogue with the agencies. And often, it, especially, you know, across the state, you probably have areas where management isn't as there aren't as many resources for that particular activity. And that's not unusual for things like that to be discussed in our hearings. Now, the solution still lies at the agency level, and the executive making a management plan or a choice of how to activate it. But absolutely, that's one of the feedback that you'd get to be able to try to affect change.
That's a very intriguing question, because I mean, I think that you can recognize a successful performance measurements management system when you'll see on the office doors of each office the posting of the latest set of performance indicators. And I think, I mean, we tend to think that if employees at the very first level get feedback on how they're doing in terms of citizen reaction, that will encourage them. Now, in Oregon, I think you have begun to get into citizen service, citizen satisfaction question. I understand that now there is a framework being done whereby each of the agencies is supposed to, in the next biennium, pretty much have customer satisfaction measurements in there. Now, that will be a great opportunity to feed back to the lower-level employees, because I particularly if you disaggregate them. I mean, part of the dilemma, again, is the disaggregation issue, because you have a facility, and all you provide to them is data on the statewide satisfaction levels. It's not going to be nearly as good as if you provide them the satisfaction levels for that particular facility, because that's what that employee will register with. I mean, so that's a very emerging piece of business that I think many government offices are trying to move towards.
They're delivering the services out on the ground. I mean, they sit on them the time.
Mm-hmm. Caseload's so big. Well, the caseload's too big, it should show up in poor results. Now, but what the employees will say, I mean, they'll say, look, I'm going to be penalized for that, and it's you damn legislators, because you're not giving us enough staff. I mean, that's the trade-offs that you've got to worry about.
Well, it is showing malnourished children and
dead
children, and so in some cases it's showing
them. And that's what the data, hopefully,
that's what we'll
show.
Kind of piggybacking on that, the key to this whole deal, like any successful business, back to this culture issue, how do we as policymakers break through kind of the bunker mentality of the, you know, employees that live in the remoted castle? It's, we have no contact with them. There's cross currents in terms of union issues and job protection and job security issues. Now, how do we create that?
Well, you could provide, right, we talked about
entrepreneurial investment by the employee.
Well, it's a complicated issue. It's a lot of things.
Yeah,
little steps that you can take. Again, I think if you take interest in these indicators, it's going to go down. I think if you have recognition awards, provide for those, I think it will have helped. There's all sorts of employee type of incentives that conceptually will help. But you do have to have a good set of performance indicators in the first place. I mean, that's, unfortunately, that is a basic building block of all of this.
But that's, you know, that kind of, I'm hearing you say that's the whip. You know,
I didn't mean to move
it. Yeah.
Well, the recognition awards, I hope, are carrots.
I think some of it's using the information. If you as a decision maker in working with in the forums that the legislature has, whether it's a committee hearing or other, show the interest and the use of, then it makes a difference to not only the citizen but the frontline worker and to the head of an agency if they see that it has importance and it has some use in decision making.
You know, it's interesting. We just did last year we did a study at the federal government level. We had the same issues, because we didn't see the penetration. So we went out and tried to find cases of what people were doing to use outcome information in the agencies at the lower levels. And we found a lot of cases. You know, the health department's not looking at the data on incidence of TB. They're not throwing that away. They're using that information. I mean, you have a lot of people down there who probably are using the outcome information today. It's just that you're introducing a much broader scope of stuff where they're not. Yes.
I think we've had a question back here for a long time. Sorry.
Kind of similar. Given the fiscal condition of this state, we are asking a lot of agencies to do more with less. But as policymakers, we are facing the inevitable pushback of how can you expect us to do more with what you're getting with less? That's what we hear in a lot of our committees. And there really isn't the capability there to provide much in terms of rewards and incentives to do it well, because we're going to be asking.
I would respectfully just
why don't you disagree on that?
I mean, if the answer is, you know, that if the performance act, if we don't give them the money and they claim that there's a certain staffing level or money needed, then they won't be doing as well. Those agencies, however, who I see this process working this session for us, is that if they are doing well and they're using this data the way we're talking about using it, then they're the ones going to get funded. Those agencies that aren't using the data.
I mean, I understand that, but I think also we're going to get into scenarios where agencies are going to tell us, and maybe even realistically in some cases, that they can't keep up the same performance level.
I would expect that.
That's an important thing, but we're going to understand.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I think ideally that to the extent where you can tie performance to the budget, where you'd say, well, understanding we've been funding you at this level, we're going to have to cut here because of what it is. But let's talk about what that's going to mean for your outcomes and your outputs. That instead of just saying that, okay, we assume that we can cut 20% and you just have that much waste, fraud, and abuse out there, you know, if they can sort of say, well, that means we're going to serve 5,000 fewer people in our subsidized child care program. These things should be showing up in the data, which then gets us out of just the sort of the faith concept of, well, we believe you got lots of fat, so we can cut you, or we don't have any fat, so anything you do is going to cut programs. Then that you show that up on results, and then you can have that basis of a discussion at a different level.
I've been asking this question for a long time.
Within the soup versus provide a couple of bites of full meal deal. I mean, that's the policy. We also have decided on this, and that's the hard part for me, just because data is so strong and fine, you don't believe it. That's the question that I still don't believe it. I mean, I hope you get data, and they are good analyzers, but what they get may not be proof. We have that time to go down to odds on these things.
Well, I think that's the advantage.
He just shows up and asks questions,
That's fine, because I want to take it in a different direction. We've been talking about measuring outcomes and performance. One of the things that has concerned me and the team in the overview presentation, and it's concerned us as members, and just to the staffing ratio of management and line management. And I see you do have, at least in one of your presentations, you have a schedule of executive directors. We were informed last week, that the ratio in the executive branch of management to line management is one manager to 6.27 line managers. Okay. So that raises alarm. And so I had my staff call NCSL with about immediate response back, or some emails about immediate response and a call. I'm wondering if there are standard metrics to measure, if other states have looked at this issue, and how do you, this is the input side of things, how do you set the standards so that you know that you're staffing right and are in fact efficient? Because we get a lot of anecdotal information from the rank of the file that there are one heck of a lot of managers more than needed. I'm wondering if you have pioneered, know if anybody has pioneered through this.
I don't know. I don't remember all the details on top of my head, but I know that last session a bill passed through the legislature and was enacted, and it focused on the management to staff ratio, and actually was ultimately there was a reduction to agencies that weren't meeting that management to staff ratio. And I'd be happy to look for that report and look for that piece of legislation and send it back to you. But that has been studied in our state.
Do you have any stuff collected in collating the Denver staffing ratio, personnel numbers?
I would imagine we do. It's not an area that I work in, but we do have some folks who do that. Since you did receive some information.
What we found out was that there was not much information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Drilling
down on that, but it seems to me that it's within our authority to kind of set those limits in the process without including even the executive director.
Mm-hmm.
But how to do it, we have some discussions underway in our group.
Yeah, well, when we've looked at it in Florida, what we found is that you really need to look at the data, because what some agencies have done is they classified positions as managers, even if they're not, as a way of paying somebody more, so it may not be as bad, or that if you put limits on managers, well, they have then a lead worker who's really still a manager, they're just not classified as a manager, so they don't show up on it. So it's a fairly easy measure to game if it's not carefully done. And I think in terms of basis of looking at that, then you can look at things like organizational charts, which would show clearly some of those relationships. And that's where I think that the benefit that we got in Florida with core process mapping of telling the agencies that they need to sort of lay out in pictorial form how they operate, that identifies lots of opportunities where you've got, for example, in the Highway Safety Motor Vehicle Titling Program, we found where a refund for $5 was being reviewed by five different people at different layers within the organization. Yeah, we were costing us $30 to approve a $5 refund and things like that. So I think that looking at the internal processes of the agencies are a way that you can get at that in terms of streamlining their operations rather than trying to just say, well, don't call them a manager, because the agencies will say, well, I need someone to look at this, I just won't call them a manager. So, you know, the measure changes, but nothing really changes in the bureaucracy. So you're forcing the bureaucracy to look at itself and then look at processes, I think, may be a way of getting you where you're trying to get to on that. I think it's a tough. Yeah. I don't think there's a perfect answer on that. Let me sort of share what we've done in Florida, and it's controversial, and people have different takes on this. Which was, as part of the school grading plan, if you are an F school and you're consistently an F school for more than 2 years, then kids in that school, under a school choice provision, can choose to go to another school that's not capped, because that would just cause overcrowding. We give them extra help. The district's under tremendous pressure to change leadership and the principal. if that school continues to fail, despite sort of all efforts to do it, then the kids have opportunity scholarships, and they can go take the money that they're now getting and go to a private school. It's controversial. You get lots of arguments over whether measures are fair. What do you do for low SES kids coming in? But I think that you can create a system where there are, you know, options that are there. The options are never going to be clean and easy. But, you know, at some point, you know, that there are some sanctions that can be applied.
And that's exactly where we need to go. If there's an explanation,
I think it was North Carolina that tried something a little different. They, for the low-rated schools, they sent in a team. They required a team to go in to work with them. You can always threaten them with privatization.
As long as they'll back me up right behind me, not a mile and a half away.
Thank you.
Thank you for your attention.
Oh, we'll have to go ahead. Thanks so much.
That you do have to do something. You do have to make a decision. The data can.